Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, December 5th, 2018. South Sudan Opposition Alliance faces leadership challenges.
The moment the result of the election of the chairperson was announced and he had lost, then he created a problem. He said he cannot accept the person elected. He did not question the election procedure or anything like that.
And the UN mission in South Sudan condemns what it calls brutal sexual assault on women and girls in Bentiu.
These attacks on vulnerable civilians are absolutely abhorrent and must stop. The violent assaults happened in a government-controlled area where the government has primary responsibility for the safety of civilians.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan Opposition Alliance that signed the September 12 peace deal has disintegrated into two factions, one led by General Peter Gadet Yak and the other faction led by Gabriel Changson. Lamakol is a veteran South Sudanese politician and a member of the alliance. He blames Juba for the change of leadership within the alliance. Akol says the Kiir administration is using some South Sudanese politicians who are hungry for power.
They would want those issues handled outside the peace agreement, or what they call outside the box. For example, the issue of the states, the issue of the unification of the army, and the issue of the selection of ministries. And therefore, because they take it for granted that they have secured the other political parties, former detainees, even SPLM-IO. So for them, the toughest nut to crack was SUA. Now, when those people went to Juba, and they stayed there, they entered into deals with the government on such matters behind the backs of their colleagues.
And who are these people, Dr. Lam? Let's be open here.
The former interim chair and the group with him, Kasaro, Azizain Abdelbaghi, and the rest, you know them.
And so you're saying they struck a deal with Juba. What deal was it?
The deal was that they should handle certain issues, certain provisions in the agreement outside the text in the agreement itself.
Was that part of the September 12th peace agreement, that certain aspects of the agreement should be, if you like, discussed behind the doors?
The agreement is very clear what to do with the number and boundaries of the states. It is clear on what to do on the unification of the army. It is also clear on how to allocate the ministerial positions. But the government doesn't want those. They want to do it outside the text of the agreement to their liking.
And so this has led SOA to start fighting each other, because I see now there are three SOAs. There is a SOA that did not like the peace agreement. There is another SOA.
You know, the term of the interim chair has finished, has come to an end. You know, the term according to our regulations is 6 months. But because he took over the position before approving the documents, this is why he was called the interim chair. So as soon as the documents were approved, which we did on the 28th of November, the next step was to carry out elections for the 8 positions in the Leadership Council of SUA. The moment the result of the election of the chairperson was announced and he had lost, then he created a problem. He said he cannot accept the person elected. He did not question the election procedure or anything like that. His problem was with the person elected.
And how would you react to people who would say the opposition has been pointing finger at Juba and saying that Juba is not democratic, Juba is against democracy? But now democracy takes place in the opposition, and some of you are fighting democracy within the opposition. How would you react to people who would ask you that question?
Somebody who says that has a point. Yeah, we are even saying the same. So somebody who says that has a point, yeah.
The agreement gives SOA one position of vice president. Is this all about this position?
It appears that those people are starting to fight over position. But what people forget is that we still have more than 5 months to go before implementing the agreement. So they should better spare their fight until the time is near.
I mean, you are a veteran politician in South Sudan. You understand all these dynamics, and you have been in the thick of things throughout your political career. Is this the right direction that SOA is taking? People of South Sudan need peace, but you are fighting on the table already before implementing the peace.
What we are saying is that our outlook to the peace is the peace agreement, and this is why we sign it. And therefore, each of the five political stakeholders, each of them should play a positive role in implementing the agreement in the letter and the spirit. Now, one party, using the money of South Sudan, would want other people to overlook the text of the agreement and do things in the way they want. And that is what we are against.
Talking about South Sudan, Dr. Lamakol, why should the people of South Sudan trust their leaders if the leaders don't trust themselves, if they don't trust each other? Why should the people of South Sudan trust you?
Well, the trust is there. You know, we have given our former interim chair the full trust. This is why he was leading us for almost 1 year. There has never been a trust deficit. But of course, at the end of the day, you must be evaluated on the basis of what you have done or what you have not done. And therefore, if people find out that he has deviated from the line that was supposed to be followed, then of course they have the right to say, well, it stopped. And he should also have the grace to accept the verdict of the people.
That's Lamakol, member of a faction of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance led by Peter Gadet Yak. South Sudan in Focus made several attempts to speak with Gabriel Changson, the leader of the other faction of SOA. But Changson said he was busy in meetings. The United Nations mission in South Sudan is condemning what it calls brutal sexual attacks on women and girls in the town of Bentiu in former Unity State. The special representatives of the Secretary General in South Sudan says the women and girls were beaten, robbed and raped. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan condemns the series of brutal sexual attacks on women and girls travelling from their villages to the town of Bentiu in the Unity region of South Sudan. At least 125 girls sought medical treatment after having been raped or sexually assaulted in a 10-day period as they walked along the roads near Nialdu and Geet on their way to Bentiu. They report the attacks as having been carried out by young men in civilian clothing or military uniforms.
David Scherer, the special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says UNMISS has sent peacekeepers to patrol the area. He also says human rights teams have launched an investigation to identify the perpetrators. He urges leaders of armed forces operating in the area to control their troops to ensure that reg elements within their ranks are not assaulting women or involved in any other criminal activity.
These attacks on vulnerable civilians are absolutely abhorrent and must stop. The violent assaults happened in a government-controlled area where the government has primary responsibility for the safety of civilians. UNMISS has held urgent meetings with authorities and is urging them to take immediate action to protect women and girls in the area and hold the perpetrators of these terrible crimes to account.
South Sudan People's Defense Forces spokesman Major General Lul Rai Kwang denies allegations that South Sudan government soldiers assaulted women and girls in Bentiu town, but says his government will investigate the attacks.
To be honest, we are not responsible for the alleged rapes that were allegedly committed from 19 to 29. However, we are going to do our own investigation. And should we find some elements within our forces responsible for it, they will be held to account.
Kwang claims several criminals come from the UNMISS-run camps. He accuses SPLAIO forces of crisscrossing into government-controlled areas on their way to the UN protection of civilian sites.
There are some hotspot areas, and that's why I say UNMISS has been aware about this. There is a place called Tawad Nyane. Tawad Nyane is much closer to UNMISS, and we have heard reports of IAO personnel coming out of the bush using it as a gateway to access enemies. And before they get into enemies' compound, or POCs, they would hide their weapons. They go and see whoever they want to see, to visit. When they are done, they would get out, recover their weapons, and commit a lot of criminal activities around that area.
Colonel Lampo Gabriel, SPLM-IO's deputy spokesperson, says the government in Juba must admit it when offences are committed by South Sudan Army, and he says the warring parties must establish cantonment sites so that criminals are easily identified.
We are not really responsible for those attacks on the civilians or for those harassment that happen, especially the red cases. But as human beings, we can't rule out some unruly soldiers. What we are going to do, and it's already happened, that we are going to be a committee against that to investigate this allegation. I already talked about it sometimes, but they'll be investigated, and we'll find out exactly where these people came from.
Lamtungwa, Information Minister for Northern Leeds State, says his government was shocked to receive the information through what he calls unusual format. He says this is the first time a large-scale rape has taken place in his state, but at the same time says the information released so far has not been proven.
Not because I'm actually denying the allegation that rape cases have not happened in the Northern Leeds during the crisis. They happen even during before the crisis. Usually people actually rape girls or women, and they will come through a certain process. We have a police really working on civil cases, homicides, and other cases that are within the state of Northern Leeds, inside the civil population. In case somebody comes to the hospital, for example, and say that I've been raped, the first thing that will happen as a doctor, before the doctor starts treating such a person, procedures start. They will usually notify the Northern Leeds state government or the police department.
Pramila Patin, the UN Special Representatives on Sexual Violence and Conflict, Virginia Gamber, and Adama Dieng, the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, have all called on the South Sudan government to end the chronic impunity that prevails across the country. Top UN diplomats urge the South Sudan government to uphold its primary responsibility of protecting and ensuring the safety of its population, irrespective of their ethnic or political affiliation, and to ensure that all victims receive essential medical, psychosocial, and legal support necessary for their recovery. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
An official with the Physical Rehabilitation Reference Center in Juba says gunshots and snake bites are the main causes of disabilities in South Sudan. The manager of the center says more than 3,000 cases of disability registered last year were from the northern part of the country. The International Committee of the Red Cross says if peace prevails in South Sudan, the number of people with disability could fall. Onen Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
The ICRC constructed the Physical Rehabilitation Reference Center in 2008 and handed it over to the South Sudan's Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare in 2009. 44-year-old James Duop, one of the beneficiaries at the center, was fitted with an artificial limb on his right thigh. He says his leg was blown off by a landmine when he was a soldier in former Jonglei State's Akobo County in 1995. Duop says he was rushed to Lopiding Hospital in Lokichokio, Kenya, where his lower limb was amputated.
Yeah, at that time it was a front line. Then the enemy come and threatening us with a landmine. But early in the morning, I tried to walk around our place. Then I went and got the landmine, was being landed by some enemy. Then I step on it, then he take off. That's why it was the time that I got that accident.
Duop says he is glad he can move on his own, but learning how to walk with an artificial limb was a lengthy process.
I was trained by those of physiotherapy to move for me to support my life with it. For the first training that I got, I put the artificial leg on, then I support myself with like two crutches. But when I got it, it is a bit okay. Then I leave another crutches, then I walk with one crutches together with the artificial. That's why now then you see me walking without any support.
31-year-old Angelina Nyamai from Rukona in Bentiu was bitten by a snake. She is able to get around on a prosthesis fitted to her right leg. Speaking in Arabic Juba, Nyamai says her life changed forever one day when she went to fetch water from the River Nile.
My leg was bitten by a snake when it got me inside water. Then these people, ICRC, took me to Lupiding Hospital where they amputated my leg. They then gave me prosthesis, which I am using for walking. It is now good with me. I had gone to fetch water. I did not even see how big the snake was. After 3 days, my leg got swollen. Then my mom took me to Lupiding Hospital in 1999 when I was 12 years old.
Stephen Okwen Agwet, director of the Physical Rehabilitation Reference Center, says most persons at the center are the victims of either gunshots or snake bites. Okwen says snake bite patients are usually brought to the center from remote areas where there are no doctors. He says by the time they reach a health facility, it may be too late to save their limb or even their life.
South Sudan is a huge area, and I think it's a lot of bushes. Because when people are more, some of them are used to bite in the rivers also sometimes. So these are areas which people used to get infected by these snake bites.
Okwen says the number of registered patients with disabilities varies between 1,000 and 3,000 people a year in South Sudan.
Last year, we managed to register about a total of 3,156 statistics of the people who get services in these three centers for the whole year.
Speaking at an event marking World Disability Day this week, Esther Ikere, Undersecretary in the Ministry of Gender, Child, Social Welfare, says most people with disabilities have limited access to basic social services such as education, health, and employment. She says her ministry is working to change that.
The Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare develop a national disability and inclusion policy.
Officials with the Physical Rehabilitation Reference Center say the number of South Sudanese with disabilities will fall once there is peace in the country. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at efforts to bring the Ebola outbreak under control in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you wrote a story of your life, how would it begin?
This is my story. Through my life, I've been through ups and downs.
I will begin from my childhood, how I was a child, and then how I progressed to become an adult, and especially during my school times. There are so many things I can recall.
I think I would begin with the words like, God is good, because I've achieved in life, because God made me to achieve.
Humble. My beginning has been humble, and to be where I am today is just a grace of God.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is in its fifth month, with projections by the World Health Organization that it will take at least 6 more months to bring it under control. The location in a conflict zone has complicated international response and frustrated aid workers. More than 20 violent incidents have kept aid workers off the area. Peter Salama is WHO's Deputy Director General of Emergency Preparedness and Response. He tells VOA's Paul Alexander about the challenges.
Paul, this is perhaps the most complex context for an Ebola outbreak that we've ever experienced. In that light, the outbreak is still ongoing. The first wave, which is really in the north of North Kivu province, an area called the Grand Nord, is largely under control around Mangina and Mabalako. Where now the focus of the epicenter of the outbreak and the focus of the response is very much Beni and a city that's been infected in the last few weeks called Butembo, which has about 1 million people.
So are things getting better or worse or just the same?
It's not a black and white answer. Whereas the outbreak tends now to be moving quite steadily in a south direction. The areas in the north more under control, but the ones in the south, the outbreak still has a number of hotspots that are yet to be fully controlled. And it's going to take at least 6 months before we would be able to be in a position to declaring this outbreak over.
So how have your operations been affected by the security issues and the periodic attacks on Beni?
The direct effects, of course, are the fact that since the outbreak was declared on August the 1st, there have been more than 20 significant violent incidences, especially in and around Beni. When the communities are attacked or massacred, as they have been on several occasions over the last few months, they respond with days of protest. Sometimes they last for several days. In Beni, for example, the community called a ville morte in French, basically a dead city, literally, and it was basically a lockdown for the whole city, including the Ebola response, for 4 or 5 days. And you see that in the data. We see that every time we've had a major violent incident, the performance of the contact tracing, the percentage of people that are followed up as they should be on a daily basis, dips quite precipitously. It generally recovers, but it takes a few days to recover back to the 90-95% coverage that we'd like to see. So that's the direct effect, and of course that has a psychological impact on our staff. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a major attack on Beni, right next to the guest house where our staff are staying, and the staff had their hotel rooms were shot at. There was bullets going through the windows and the walls. An ordnance and a mine landed on the roof of the guest house. We were lucky that it didn't explode. Otherwise, we would have had a lot of injuries and perhaps even fatalities. So we had to evacuate 20 of our staff for psychological first aid a couple of weeks ago. The indirect impact is, of course, that for this population, especially in and around Beni, they've been subject to this kind of violence for years, in fact, in some circumstances, decades. And for them, every time there's an attack, the response from the community is quite literally, look, we are engaging with the Ebola response. We're very supportive of it. But you have to understand, as an international community and as the national authorities, that for us, our physical protection is paramount, and we expect you to do more about that. There's a vicious cycle, Paul, between the insecurity and community mistrust.
Are you still running into that hostility and resistance from local communities, too?
The response to the Ebola program has been very, very positive from the community.
Have you considered broader pullouts or relocating your people to safer location?
Not at present. So far, our colleagues, we don't believe, have been deliberately targeted. They've just been caught in the crossfire.
So would you say that you are optimistic that this will be over in 6 months?
I've said that it's going to take a minimum of 6 months before we can declare this outbreak over. We also are very, very encouraged by the fact that neighboring countries have taken already some very robust steps to be prepared.
That was WHO's Peter Salama speaking with my colleague Paul Alexander. The U.S. military does not always advertise it, but it has troops all over Africa. Their mission usually small and always done at the request of the nations they are in. The leader of the U.S. Army in Africa, Sergeant Major Jeremiah Ayman, tells my colleague Clara Babs about their mission.
You know, we can always use more. If you give me 10 more people, I can do more things. But we've seen over the last few years with the downsizing of the military, we've been able to be successful with that adequate amount of troops. There's rumors of getting the SFAB to come down and support the operations. They support and advise units on the ground. So they do some training activities, so the regional allocated force doesn't have to go down and do that.
So what region of Africa would that be placed in?
It would be spread across. They wouldn't be based in Africa. It would be like now we use 2nd Brigade 101 to go down there and achieve a certain objectives based off the request of the countries. So spread out across the continent, doing everything from counter-IED training battalion-level staffs, logistics training, intelligence training, and so forth.
That would be a big deal for U.S. Army Africa. Can you talk a little bit about how big this would be and how many people would be involved?
So if we had dedicated forces, it'd probably be around 2,000 soldiers.
People are suspicious of any U.S. military presence on the continent. So speaking to our audience, why should they or should they not be suspicious of U.S. Army presence?
So we don't launch down on the continent without a country's permission. It usually goes through the country team, through State Department, through a request through Joint Chief Staff to come for military assistance.
What's the benefit to U.S. Army Africa for doing that?
If we can strengthen a country so we don't have to deploy there, that builds our readiness and supports our objectives as well.
The Lake Chad Basin, there's been an increased presence there. Is that because the threat has also increased there, or is that because the partners now need more help? Explain why we're there.
That's where the bad guys are going, and they're starting to disrupt some of the countries there. They requested our assistance, and we're going to go and assist as requested by the government, not fighting side by side, but advising and assisting our African partners.
Is the threat growing?
I wouldn't say it's growing, no. I say it's getting contained.
You train on everything from how to be a better soldier to how to work with the government to counterterrorism. Which do you do the most of?
So logistics is very difficult in the continent. You can't, there's no I-10, there's no I-95. So figuring out how to resupply their troops, set up their networks, make sure they're sustainable, that's very important for some countries. On the other hand, some countries are very concerned about counter-IED operations. So we assist with that aspect. So intelligence, counter-IED, basic infantry training, NCO development, we pretty much kind of do everything.
What countries are we focusing on counter-IEDs?
Oh, pretty much all of them. Yeah, it's just like Iraq or Afghanistan. The materials are easy to get. They're readily there, easy to plant and hard to detect.
The base that's being created, the drone facility in Niger, is also going to have armed drones. That's been announced by both Niger and the United States at this point. Who are these drones going to protect? Is it going to just be the U.S., just be U.S. Army Africa guys? Or is it going to be our partners as long as they're with us? Or is it going to be if they request for the help? Explain that to me.
Drones are great for surveillance and also if needed to be armed to take out a high-value target or respond to a crisis, whether it's U.S. or our partner forces. So they're there to assist our partners on the continent as well.
So you said in a crisis. So it sounds like you're not going to be using these to actively target extremist like it does in Somalia. It's going to be on a defensive basis.
Targeting, that's not up to me. I don't know who they target.
And another thing I know that a lot of the African countries are asking for is intelligence.
So the intel shared as a as-needed basis. We're presently working on standing up intel training in Nigeria. In Tunisia, we've stood up an intel training center and also recently just completed intel training in Kenya as well.
That's U.S. Army Command Sergeant Major Jeremiah Ayman speaking with VOA Karl Abab at the Pentagon. That's our show for this Wednesday when I leave you with the song Kelele by Hardlife Avenue Stars. I've been listening to Hardlife Avenues with the song Kelele. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.